I have a truly extraordinary panel of leaders on this stage this afternoon to start us on our discussion. Of course, in the center, we have former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who is here to talk about the need for a reemergence of American leadership on many of these issues. I also have, to her right, Hattie Babbitt, former permanent representative of the U.S. to the Organization of American States, and also she served as deputy administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development and can talk at length about how our NGOs are now playing a role in leadership and in defining issues. We also have Ambassador John Bruton, former Irish Prime Minister and currently the European Union Ambassador to the United States. Ian Forbes, on my far right, who is a retired admiral of the Royal Navy and also was representative in many international organizations and will be able to talk to us this afternoon about NATO and security issues of the future. And finally, last but not least, on my right, Ashraf Ghani, who is currently Chancellor of Kabul University and Chairman of the Institute of State Effectiveness and formerly was Finance Minister in Afghanistan between July 2002 and December 2004. I'm going to ask the panelists to make brief opening remarks, and then we will turn the discussion over to you all for questions on the topics that they address. So with that introduction, Madeleine, would you start us off, please? Great.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm delighted to be here and to be on this panel. There are so many things to talk about because I think that the international system is out of kilter. And while I was known as Multilateral Madeleine, I think, in fact, that many of the multilateral institutions that exist are not working as they should. I was Ambassador of the United Nations for 4 years and feel very strongly about the importance of that institution, but it needs very serious reform, the Security Council being the first issue. I generally talk about it as a Rubik's Cube problem. When we were in office, we believed that Germany and Japan should be made permanent members of the Security Council by virtue of their size and economic contributions. And so what happened, the first country that came to me to object to that was Italy. And the Italian ambassador said, "This is totally unfair. We need to be permanent members of the Security Council because we lost the war too," which is a rather peculiar campaign slogan. The other part of the Rubik's Cube aspect is represented by Ambassador Bruton, which is that at any given time, I would go to a European ambassador, and at any given time, 5 out of the 15 members are Europeans. And most of them at that stage, some were in the EU, some wanted to be in the EU. So I'd go to an EU ambassador and I'd ask for his vote, and they'd say, "I'm so sorry, I can't help you because the EU does not yet have a common position." And then 2 days later, I'd go back to the same person. I'd say, "Can you help me now?" And he'd say, "I'm so sorry, I can't help you. The EU does have a common position," which means the EU should have one permanent seat, but I can't visualize either Great Britain or France giving up its veto. So that is part of the Rubik's Cube aspect, and it's only one small part of what needs to be reformed at the UN. I also think that we have the wrong stakeholders within the international system, and I hope that we talk about this more, because the truth is that a multinational corporation of major size has more influence over the international system than, and to pick a country where I hope nobody's from at the moment, than Uruguay. And so the question is how an international system would have representatives from business as well as non-governmental organizations as well as not as states and non-state actors. But part of what I did want to talk about was the U.S. role. I believe in the goodness of American power, and I also was the person that was most identified with a phrase which actually President Clinton used first, which is the indispensable nation. And I continue to believe that within the future international system that the U.S. has to continue to be the indispensable nation, but however, indispensable, at least the way I define it, does not mean alone. Indispensable actually means actively engaged in solving international issues. And so I would hope that what can happen as part of the solution is that the United States sees itself, one, as a contributor to the reorganization of the international system. We, after all, were the progenitors of the UN and a lot of the Bretton Woods organizations and a lot of what Dean Acheson talked about when he wrote Present at the Creation. And we, I think, need to be a part of the recreation because no matter what, I think we will continue to be the indispensable power. What is makes it difficult, however, is the numbers that just came out of this Pew survey. I am the co-chair of it with Senator Danforth. I was, I have to tell you, first the chair, but the first time that the results came out from 38,000 questioners, and it came out that the U.S. numbers were bad, in fact, that people didn't like us, the Wall Street Journal wrote an op-ed, or an ed, that said, of course, 38, of course this was bad. Madeleine Albright was the chair of the Pew survey, so we decided that it had to be bipartisan. And this time we questioned 45,000 people in 47 countries. And out of that, the U.S. unfavorability ratings are worse than they have ever been. And I just returned from Turkey, and this is a sign. Turkey, a NATO ally, and one of the most important to me strategic friends that we can have, our unfavorability ratings now are 83%, 9% like us there. That is very serious. In the Ivory Coast, our unfavorably ratings are only 11, but it's not quite the same position as Turkey. I do think that the issue here is how, as my colleagues here talk about what an international system looks like, what role will the United States take? And I personally believe that even after the Iraq War, because it will end, believe me, at some point, the United States is going to have to be an active part, which means that our leaders are going to have to make the case very strongly that in American national interest, we are better off as partners and the indispensable nation within some kind of a newly functioning international system. I just want to make one other point, which is that the rest of the world is also going through a number of different organizational changes and a lot of questions about how the Europeans work with each other. And I was just showing this chart to Ambassador Bruton. When I first came to the became secretary, I hated to admit that I did not know every European organization. So I asked our intelligence and research part of the department to create for me a chart that would show the European organizations. I think you can see this a little bit. It is such a combination of things that we started calling it the Euro mess because of the duplication and the difficulties of creating a lot of ad hoc systems in order to deal with whatever the immediate problem was. So as we deal with these issues, I think we have to think more long-term than while certain ad hoc coalitions are important, that we can't just go ad hoc.
Thank you, Madeleine. Hattie, one of the lessons learned that we're already coming out of this Aspen Ideas Festival is that we've not spent much time on Latin America or Latin American issues, and certainly you may be able to speak to that in your former role at the Organization of American States, but I also know you have great knowledge of and involvement with NGOs, and so would be very interested in your perspective on how multilateral institutions can incorporate NGOs into their decision and governance processes.
Well, you all ask us to think about the multilateral organizations or multilateral approaches to the 21st century, and the best way for me to think about that is to sort of think about what's the stage and who are the actors. And the diplomats, we used to sit around the Department of State and lament that the urgent always took the place of the important, that we were always putting out fires and never getting the important issues. The good news, this is where we're looking for good news, is that there's really a growing global consensus that these large multilateral issues, these large global issues, are both urgent and important. I mean, we've got climate change, we have terrorism, we have all these issues. I thought I'd talk a little bit about climate change because it's been a big issue at Aspen, and it's certainly one of the issues that multilateral organizations and the world is going to have to face. And, you know, here's where we think big, start small and act now. I mean, the think big, eventually we need to have 192 nations, members of the United Nations, as part of one global organization dealing with climate change. it's hard to imagine that you can sit down with 192 nations and negotiate a complex set of issues like that. And although you can certainly construct a situation where you'd have, the 15 most culpable and most affected nations sit down and work it and then pitch it into the United Nations. The starting small, I'm going to disagree a little bit with Madeline in the sense that I'm a little bit of a proponent of the starting small when you, or at least to identify regional organizations or sectoral issues where you can get consensus and convergence more quickly. So, for example, in the United States, where the administration has had a worse than a total failure of leadership on climate change, it's been denying the science and inhibiting the progress of others on the issue. The New England states got together and put together a process for a cap-and-trade system and a cap on emissions. Governor Schwarzenegger in California has done the same. A number of the western states are eager to become part of that. On the business and NGO side, and I think this is really a very interesting example, Jeff Immelt at GE and Alan Belda at Alcoa and the folks at Duke Energy have joined with, you know, the World Resources Institute and the NRDC, the National Resources Defense Council, to put together something called the United States Climate Action Partnership, saying, look, global climate change is real, it's caused by people, it's an urgent problem, the solution is a cap and trade system. Those kinds of things feed into building consensus. FT had a wonderful piece yesterday on the advancing number and importance of coalitions between business and NGOs, where the businesses say, well, we can't wait for multilateral organizations to catch up. We can't even wait for our government to catch up. We have to do something now and push the process. So I think that's an important element. I wish the United States were in a leadership position, but we can't wait. We've got to move ahead on these issues, and these central solutions are pretty good ones. The only other thought I would leave, and I have lots of thoughts, but I'll leave them for the question and answer period, and that is that the institutional answers to these questions, it seems to me, have worked the best when they were the most focused and worked incrementally. We're all talking now about how the post-World War II institutions aren't really serving us very well, the Bretton Woods organizations, the UN, and others. But if you look at the EU, and I'm not going to talk much about the EU because we have the world's reigning expert on the panel, but the EU started off as a coal and steel community, and it moved into a series of trade agreements, and it moved into a customs union, and it moved into a currency area, and it grew as people became more comfortable with a loss of sovereignty, as the issues changed and needed to be addressed. And now we in the world look at the EU with and are as invested in the success of the EU in dealing with some of these issues because it's a successful model with for how to put together, even if not in the UN context, a multilateral organization. Or you look at the WTO. The WTO started off dealing with trade and tariff issues. By 1995, the General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs had turned into the WTO. It had an enforcement mechanism. It had a much broader range of issues to deal with. So as we look at multilateral institutions for the 21st century, I think we really have to pay attention to the sort of successful model of incremental growth and focusing really on who the actors are, how to bring in the NGOs, and what the stage is. And the stage is eventually global, but maybe it's not initially global.
Thank you, Hattie. John, as representative from the European Union and certainly an organization that has reinvented itself repeatedly over the decades, as Hattie noted, what's your perspective on how multilateral institutions can govern in some of these intractable problems?
Well, I think the strength of the European Union is that it's multifunctional. It has an energy dimension. It has a dimension to do with internal market. It has a dimension of foreign policy. It has a dimension of transferring money from richer to poorer parts of the European Union. And the fact that it has those multitude of functions means that it's actually able to have trade-offs. Somebody who may have to give some ground for the sake of an overall agreement in one area may implicitly be compensated on another, or there may be an understanding that, you know, a consideration will be given when we come to consider some other topic of the fact that you've helped us through on this. I think the problem with multilateral organizations for other countries that are not part of a group like that is that they're each treaty is individual. The United States, I think, is party to 600 multilateral agreements, but each one of those is freestanding. So the US can't, if it makes a concession in one multilateral organization which goes beyond what is in the US interest to do but is good for the world as a whole, it can't be compensated within that, because there isn't a sort of a networking or a mechanism, an agreed mechanism for trade-offs, which the European Union is effectively. And I think that that's one of the contributions to thinking that the EU could make. We set out in our security strategy, which we adopted in 2003, which I'm sure Madeleine in particular would be familiar with, we said our goal was effective multilateralism. And this was hailed as something very brilliant. I'm not too sure whether it was or not. It was only a phrase. But I think what it probably meant is something like what I'm saying, creating a series of building blocks in the world, of which the EU would be one, which internally can do trade-offs, who can then do trade-offs in a manageable negotiation with five or six other blocks in the world, and thereby create something that works. I think the difficulty is with continuing with the system of freestanding individual multilateral agreements where such trade-offs aren't possible and where each country is negotiating individually. I think it was something of a miracle that the last Uruguay round was concluded at all. And I know Peter Sutherland quite well. And basically, he banged the gavel and said, it is agreed. Now, in fact, there were several people in the room who didn't agree, but they were intimidated by his personality and by the noise of the gavel, and they shut up, and they then ratified the thing. The same happened at the convention drafting the European Union Constitution. Now, that has had a history of its own afterwards, but if it wasn't for Valéry Giscard d'Estaing being sometimes a benevolent despot and sometimes just a despot, we'd never have got the thing through. And I mean, I all credit to him. I mean, he drove it through, and when it went through, all the governments signed up to it and did their best, or their varying best, to get it through. But you know, this is the trouble with the very large numbers where you require everyone to agree, that you know, it's just going to be very, very difficult. We saw it again, and we see it in Europe all the time, where we are dealing with things where there has to be a unanimous decision. So we need to, I think, to move to a system of blocks based on the capacity for internal trade-offs.
All right, thank you, John. Ian, you've come from multilateral institutions from a security perspective. Would you like to comment on some of the challenges going forward from that angle?
Well, I'm delighted to be here in Aspen. Thank you for your generous introduction. I am a retired Royal Navy four-star admiral. I freely admit I'm a long way from the sea, but I'm feeling pretty comfortable. I'm also, I think, one of the few Brits who's been wandering around. So if I could just sort of open with a personal Brit statement before I make a few remarks. I did 39 years in the military. I worked very closely with the American military from the rank of lieutenant right the way up to four-star. I think that experience, apart from being very enjoyable, made me a committed Atlanticist. Just let me give you two vivid personal experiences. The first was the Falklands. Any of us who were down there on the front line, and I was, were absolutely convinced that we wouldn't have prevailed down there without US support in the shape of weaponry and the shape of intelligence. Example one. Secondly, Yugoslavia, where I was involved for one reason or another in the policy end, on the ground in Sarajevo, and then running the battle group off Kosovo when Ms. Albright was Secretary of State. And I experienced, I think, firsthand there throughout that process the strength and the influence of what I would call American power. So I'm, to start off with, a great believer in effective, and I think I'm going to plagiarize Madeleine's goodness of American leadership. And the necessity of it in tackling global problems. I left Heathrow 3 days ago. It's been raining in UK for about 2.5 weeks. We've had unprecedented flooding for a summer in the north of England. We've also had a bomb in, well, it didn't go off, but we've had a bomb in Glasgow, and we've also had a bomb in London. And when I got to Terminal 4, everything stopped because we had another bomb scare and everyone was off the planes and we came to a grinding halt, which is why I was a day late in arriving. All of these events have had a chaotic effect on travel, the economy, tourism, public confidence, etc. So when I was reflecting on this in the plane, this, you know, a little bit of climate change impact, a little bit of domestic terrorism, confronting a government machinery at some stretch, a new government, incidentally, in tandem, it really struck me that network governance, an interesting term, i.e. our ability to coordinate collective efforts domestically and internationally, was very much one of the significant challenges at the moment. My field is clearly security and defence. My particular experience is, as Joan said, NATO, and it's this organisation I just want to make a few brief comments about. NATO's had a very lively 15 years. I sort of capture it in the term that it's been chasing a rationale in a very fast-moving security setting and always slightly lagging it, but it's done rather well. From Article 5 operations, that's standard defence, to peacekeeping in Bosnia, to peace enforcement in Kosovo, to peace enforcement and support and stabilisation operations in Afghanistan. And it's moved very rapidly in changing itself to adapt, to cope with all these new external geopolitical drivers that have taken it really beyond its original comfort zone, which was nice static operations with static forces and a rather static culture. But in reality, it probably hasn't been able to move as fast as it wanted to. Internally, notwithstanding new missions, new capabilities, and new members, it is, I think it's probably fair to say, being tested to the limit. Because the decision to go out of area, a significant decision, made in Iceland, and I was in the room when it was made, as I believe General Powell was as well, to move beyond NATO's previous borders was absolutely an immense decision. And the consequences were significant. You know, if you were in a commercial business, it was like taking a domestic business suddenly offshore and international. And we did it in a stroke, and we didn't do it with any prior preparation. So what has flown on the back of that, the Afghan mission, is a real test. And NATO, for all the good reasons, viz. Afghanistan, really cannot afford to fall short on this test. Because failure there, I believe, would have very profound consequences, obviously not only for Afghanistan, but for NATO as well, probably more profound than UNPROFOR had for the United Nations. So this has been a learning process for NATO, and we're trying hard to catch up, and I wouldn't try and give you any false impression that it's not quite a struggle. There are some big lessons. There's been a gap, I think, between what I would call the rhetoric of nations signing up to missions and the reality of being prepared to resource them. There's been a failure on occasion of force generation, providing the right numbers to go on the right missions, and we have in areas fallen short. I've seen the Secretary General going from nation to nation in his various delegations looking for one and two helicopters from nations. Now, this is clearly not, you know, effective force generation. There's been a tendency, once forces are in theatre, in terms of rules of engagement, to place caveats on respective national contingents. And what this means is that the nation will sign up to providing a contingent to go on the deployment, but then it limits it to the missions that it might be able to undertake. Now, clearly, this is extraordinarily difficult for force cohesion. It's extraordinarily difficult for a force commander as to how he configures his force, and it really isn't particularly intelligent for mission success. There are lots of others, but I won't dwell on them. Those are internal problems that I think the alliance is having to deal with, and progress is being made. There's a bigger issue, and I think we've sort of touched on it with the other panellists, and that's an external one, that in today's complexity, in the failing state scenario, or in security issues generally, the problems are not solved by the use of military force alone. And General Powell, I think, made mention of this yesterday. It is a tool, but it is a relatively blunt one. In Afghanistan, for instance, the collective levers of international power, I think, are probably out of sync, and I'm sure we talked about this morning, and I won't steal your thunder. But the military track under NATO is going at one speed, and the other tracks, political, diplomatic, economic reconstruction, are going at another. And clearly, from a strategic overview point of view, this is not intelligent, and the words strategic failure, you know, sort of waft around in the outfield, and that sends a rather chilly wind. So undoubtedly one element associated with this is the fact that coordination between global institutions in the security context, the UN, NATO, the EU, the World Bank, etc., what I would term up at the strategic level, it's patchy. I won't go any further than that, but it's pretty patchy. In some cases, it's reached a point of almost being non-existent. Now, the upshot is that we then got a less than sensible division of labour when we go into these particular scenarios, and a less than sensible common approach. And looking at the threats in the security field that we touched on here over the last 2 to 3 days, we have to really make progress here, and it's a big issue. We don't appear to have a global security forum or market, rendering our intervention models some 2 decades after we first went in terms of Bosnia, rendering them as anything less than inefficient. Perhaps we need something. For at present, it seems that with all the lessons of intervention over the last 15 years, which many of us in this room have learned, we remain less than capable of forging institutional relationships between our primary security providers with the speed that we should. We have to find ways of improving this, and I think maybe this is an area where the private sector, looking at this very critically, may well be able to help. I'm very conscious that over my 5 minutes, this picture has been somewhat gloomy. It wasn't meant to be, but we are here to look at problems after all. However, let me finish on a high note. When despairing a little bit about the road ahead, a glance in the rear view mirror to see how NATO, how far it's come, is always rather heartening. Just let me give you 3. We all know them, but they're worth rehearsing in a forum like this. Stability in Bosnia, the most successful post-conflict mission of the modern era, and NATO was at the heart of that. The Baltic states in NATO, unthinkable a decade ago, and NATO was at the heart of that. And last but by no means least, German military force on the ground in Afghanistan. I doubt Willy Brandt would have ever believed it. So there is much that we have to do. We're doing a lot, but there does remain an awful lot more to do. Thank you very much.
Ian, thank you. Ashraf, you come at this from a slightly different perspective, and you have been involved, obviously, over the last 5 or 6 years in rebuilding a country and in dealing with multilateral institutions from a different perspective. Could you please share with us some of the challenges you see and what you think the way ahead could be?
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. The first thing is about governance. In 1965 is the first use of the term to mark the shift from administration as a hierarchical phenomenon and from management as a hierarchical phenomenon within the corporation, because it was top-down to lateral. So the key issue really here is about shift to shared decision-making processes, not hierarchical domination. And not surprisingly, the word came from the university. The word governance was first used in relationship to universities. Now, if we look into globalization, what has it done to us? It's a spontaneous process that is of human making, but not of human design. So it's outstripping our institutions. It's posing challenges for which the institutions that we know were not prepared. But the problem is that we approach the problems from the mental models of the past, not in relationship to the challenges that are present and are going to confront us in the future. Because our mental perspectives are defined from the perspective of interests with which we've been raised, not the realities that are going to force us to confront the nature of our interests in different ways. One of the most difficult things for dominant powers has been the question of succession. Will they think in orderly ways about succession to a world where their dominant position is different than the world that they began with? Great Britain had enormous difficulty making the transition during the first wave of globalization, and hence we got the crisis. The second point to be made about, we don't have global institutions today. We only have international institutions. Nations as nation states are the operating members of these. And again, as Secretary Albright so eloquently said, the corporation is not present in these decisions. And the reason is very simple. Lord Keynes deeply distrusted the economy. The world of 1945 was national in economic terms, was national in political terms, national in cultural terms. Hence, a lot of restrictions on flow of money. Money was tightly controlled. This world that we live in is a world of flows. And those organizations have a great deal of difficulty. Now, to frame the point, both about in 2 ways. One, these organizations, UN, the World Bank, IMF, the whole is less than the sum of the parts. because they operate in silos. Those silos may have been justified, particularly prior to 2001, to 9/11. But after the world of 9/11, you cannot have compartmentalization into security, development, and monetary policy. Then the organizational culture of each has become distinct. The UN has never been needed more, but has least capability to govern itself and least resource to do the task that the international community requires of it. Its charter is a major asset. Today, I don't think we would be able to secure an agreement on a charter of that breadth of vision. But the organizational management day-to-day is really a problem. Dean Acheson, again, Secretary Albright mentioned him, made sure that the World Bank had a mandate that its management could do, in his word, whatever they pleased. But the problem is that the flow of financial resources has made money to the least of the problems. It is not, this world is not facing shortage of money. It is facing the institutional agenda for management of that money. And the bank has a problem doing this. The IMF lost its credibility in 1998. Again, an organization that is very much like a priesthood, incredibly competent. They must have been trained by Jesuits in their approach, rational Cartesian. But when that medicine did not fit the world of 1998, now they face a crisis. Because of this, I think need for reform becomes fundamental. On the one hand, to build on the capabilities that exist, but on the other hand, to bring them to a network governance. And this network governance today, in cases like Afghanistan, cannot be done without the cooperation in the civil societies. We need to understand that international organizations are only one link in that chain until they reform. This reform is not going to be radical under the current context. Each organization presents different possibilities, but in the discussion is not taking place, except in forums like the Aspen Festival. Why? Because most of those other discussions are about hierarchies. People, governments, take positions that are about their interests rather than about a project of collective imagination. And what we need today, I think, is a project of collective imagination of the same magnitude as the 1945 project. In 1945, as Dean Acheson again said, he felt present in creation because half the world free and democratic without blowing the whole. Today, our task surely is to how to think about the entire process of the world. The reason is very simple, twofold. One, threats are global, as Hattie so rightly said. Second, the criminalized networks are the most efficient in today's world. Network governance is best demonstrated among criminalized networks. And in places like Afghanistan, security is most threatened by those criminalized networks because they have flexibility, they have resources, and they have precision. And to move NATO or the World Bank or the UN to cope with a challenge of that type really requires imagination and leadership. And that's what we need.
Well, that's a great conclusion. I think what we'd like to do now is open the panel up to questions from the audience. If you have questions, please go to the mics on either side. And as you do that, I'd like to ask a general question of the panel. How do we begin that necessary reform? How do we bring into network governance all of the players who have a stake in the issues? How do we reassert leadership at all levels as part of this process? And after you finish answering that, then maybe we can go on to atomic fusion or fission or whatever. Secretary Albright, would you like to start?
When I said not ad hocism, I did not mean that not to do what Hattie and others have talked about, which is to build on the regional blocks, because I think those are the building blocks. The question for me, because as Ashraf pointed out, I think that the institutions, private funding, private money is providing so much investment in developing countries that the Bretton Woods organizations have nothing to do. The IADB, for instance, I went to see Moreno, and he said, we have to figure out what our mandate is. So the question is how at those lower levels to begin to do what you were talking about, to bring different stakeholders together. And that happens very rarely because it is so siloed. So I would recommend that, in fact, things like the Aspen Festival or the Clinton Global Initiative, that's another thing that happens there, is in terms of trying to put different people together. And what I have believed, I was trying to figure out, you know, how to make my life useful. I love the job that I have. It's very hard to have a better job than Secretary of State, but I managed to find a way to pull things together so that, in fact, public-private partnerships are a very important part of this, civil society, democracy building. There are all these elements in place. The question is how to find venues for them, and then to do what you were talking about, John, is how do you force people to actually make decisions? Because we don't have to make any decisions here. And to sit around a table and work out those trade-offs is what is necessary.
Hattie?
I have two thoughts, both UN thoughts. And one of them is on the role of the UN as a legitimizer. And that's a New York role. That's what that's the political consensus that's built or not in New York. And I think anybody observing it has got to say it's a very broken place. It's not a place that serves that key function. The rest of the UN, and here I want to defend the UN a little bit. I'll take peacekeeping as an example, as a place that works. The UN has about a $20 billion budget. About $2 billion of that is spent by the Secretariat in New York. A big chunk of it spent peacekeeping in, 18 or 20 hell holes around the world. Those folks, the UN Security Council decides whether to go in. It used to be that the developed countries provided the troops. We now have the payors, who are the developed countries, the United States and others, and we have the players, who the Pakistanis, the Indians, the troop contributors. It seems to be working okay, but I'm not certain that that's really a healthy long-term idea. But the peacekeeping operations, I think people would say those work pretty well. I think people would say the World Health Organization, a part of the UN, does a pretty good job of preventing pandemics. We thought they did a pretty good job with SARS. Those organizations, the farther they are from New York, the sort of happier they impression they leave and job they do. And that includes coordinating with the NGO community. Now, if you're running a peacekeeping operation in the Congo, you have to work with the people who are providing water and sanitation. And if you're in the Balkans, if you're NATO or you're the UN peacekeeping organization, you have to work with the people who are providing water and sanitation, the refugee counters who stand at the borders with the little clickers, 5,002. So in the field, the UN is often doing a much better job than we feel about this critical organization just looking at New York.
Excellent points. It gets at something that we've talked about in several panels over the last few days, and that's how do you share power and responsibility and authority over issues that have a much larger impact globally. And certainly you gave us some very good examples of where institutions are adapting and working effectively. But I'd be very interested in John's perspective, because you talked about this when you discussed the European Union, that you have been able to come up with a way to share power and share responsibility to some degree. Do you agree with that? How would you export that to other...
I think one of the European Union can't raise taxes. It cannot borrow a single cent. And yet it has tremendous power. And that power derives from the primacy of EU law, which is promulgated by the European Court of Justice in 1964, whereby if legislation is passed in a member state that's in contrary to the EU treaty or EU law trumps national law. And this has created a sort of a legal order in the European Union, which is based on an entirely voluntary agreement, because countries can withdraw from the European Union if they don't want to be in it. They can leave. And countries have joined, knowing that by joining they're accepting that their courts will be trumped if it comes to a conflict by the European Court of Justice. And we're beginning to move in that direction now in the World Trade Organization as well, with the dispute with these panels, where their decisions are being accepted as trumping US law. And Congress has somewhat reluctantly, but pretty well inevitably, come to enact legislation to remove provisions of EU law that were deemed to be incompatible with the WTO panel decisions as interpreting the WTO treaties binding the United States. So I think we probably need to have a look at the legal order and creating a legal order. But you won't do that, I think, in silos. You've got to create some sort of an overarching legal space which has political legitimacy and which people feel, you know, can feel an emotional affinity to, as well as feeling bound by in its decisions. The two run together. And that's why, I mean, I don't know enough, I must confess, about the various efforts that have been made to reform the United Nations, to reform the Security Council. And I know the European Union itself was completely divided on that and didn't pay, you know, wasn't any great help to resolving the issue. But I do think we need to get there, and I think to get there, the United States needs to lead and to paint a picture of a new global order and how it might work. The sketch as painted by the United States may not finally come into effect in all its particulars, but I think if there is a lead like that from the United States, I think it will be hard for others not to follow. And I would expect that the European Union would want to follow a US lead on this and would be prepared to accept things in the face of a US lead that it mightn't be prepared to agree to internally because of the difficulties between member states. But I think the United States' role is very important in establishing a regime of effective multilateralism, but it can't be done in 600 individual treaties. It has to be done in one overall global umbrella.
All right, thank you, John. I apologize, I can't see on this side of the room, so if you'd identify yourself and ask your question.
Sure, Chris Kelly from Booz Allen. I was really pleased to hear that at the Aspen Institute we have people starting to talk about network governance as a new item for leaders, because Aspen is a place where leadership development has to occur. So the question I would have for the panel is, as we move from the old to the new with this new idea of network governance, do our leaders have the competencies necessary to work in this new world? And if they don't, how are they going to get them?
Ms. Albright?
Of course. You answer that one.
Well, first of all, I think, let me go back on something, because I do think that generally, I'm a professor now at Georgetown, and the question is generally, how are curricula developed these days in order to teach about foreign policy and international relations? And starting back then with that level, I think most of us that have anything to do with this are more and more cognizant of telling our students that they have to understand the environment, they have to understand health. When I was in graduate school, it was a really big deal to study economics. And so basically that the agenda, the curriculum for people that are going to be involved in international affairs has to be much larger. I think also most of the leaders and incipient leaders that I know are basically much more attuned to these very questions of knowing how a variety of stakeholders are involved in it. I think the real problem comes from another trend that I wanted to point out, and that is that whether it's globalization or Europeanization, to a great extent, it is fairly impersonal. And people find it hard to identify with that and are lost to some extent in the large world of kind of uncharted waters. And Admiral's here, so I have to be careful about this. But basically, so what has happened is kind of counter to that very trend, and that is, while many people thought the nation-state concept was over, it is not. The opposite has happened. Because of this vastness of globalization, people are re-identifying with the nation state and to some extent subgroups, ethnic groups, etc., which is complicating the movement into international governance of various kinds, because people are still identifying with smaller and smaller groups. I spoke initially about the role of the United States. The United States is the most jealous of its sovereignty of any country. And as we have joined organizations whenever, we have always made exceptions for ourselves. about not going along with the rules. And it's only after a very long kind of, you're describing some of the congressional action on international, on some trade regulations, it's very difficult. And the question is how you persuade leaders as well as the voters of any country that a country is more secure if it gives up a little bit of its sovereignty to a larger organization that can then do what you were talking about, Ashraf, dealing with the criminal elements or whatever. But that is a very hard push. And if you listen to candidates and political people, the last thing they want to say is we're going to give up our power to some faceless organization. And the question is how you make that leap. It isn't that they don't know it and that the leaders aren't trained to do it and that more and more people at lower levels understand it, but it's politically very, very difficult.
Ashraf?
Thank you. The first thing to begin with in terms of leadership, because John is here, is Ireland. I mean, Ireland is one of the best examples of both taking the European Union in a globalizing world, both as a constraint as an opportunity. And the plan that they have for 2020 is one of the most amazing documents that has ever been prepared in terms of a vision. So yes, there are people that are leading. And again, at the level of municipalities, in Europe, remarkable cross-level cooperation in terms of networking is taking place. That is a place like South Carolina that is now thriving on globalization. Counties that have managed to attract as many as 50 corporations. But I think the critical role comes to organizations like Aspen, Ideas Festivals, because today when institutions have lost their critical credibility, networks again have become far more important to face-to-face relationships. And these networks really need to become broadened in terms of their composition. To be able to hear how Chinese that are really embedded in Chinese structure see globalization. How Indians see it, how Brazilians see it, how Russians see it. I've worked in Russia, China, and India, each for 5 years when I was at the World Bank. And when I hear European leaders or other leaders in the rest of the world, they do not correspond to my observational realities. It's a very different set of issues on the ground in China, in a Chinese county, than the type of image of China that is painted in Brussels. And I think it's important to have that type of dialogue so possibility can come. And agenda setting for leadership has always come from outside leadership in order to build a societal consensus. And I think that is where, again, forums have to be broadened. The universities in the United States, having taught here for 14 years, I think are really failing in this. They've become too narrow in focus, and they're dealing far too much with the past than with the future in the present. And that, again, as Madeleine was saying, the change of curriculum is going to be very critical to reaching out to a global positioning of leadership.
Patty?
I just have one thought to add to what Ashraf and Madeleine have said, and that is to underscore a word that people have used over and over, but we haven't really talked about, and that is legitimacy. How do you get legitimacy for a process that people haven't participated in? They've elected a president. They may or may not like what he does, but he's there. They've elected a governor. There's a legitimacy that comes from the electoral process, but the people in these institutions who are making decisions haven't been elected. So where does their legitimacy come from? It's not good enough for a multilateral organization to be efficient and effective. We could all design those. They have to also be legitimate in order to bring publics along. Now, I'll give an example of an NGO that's cited all the time for having enormous legitimacy and for having sort of created a world movement. And that's Jody Williams and the work she did in the anti-landmines movement. The way she describes that, and she describes it as an urban myth, that this sort of 60s woman sat by her computer and organized a global opposition to the United States position on landmines. She says, yeah, I sat at my computer and it's a nice story, but I killed myself for 2 years going around from group to group to group to group talking about landmines so that when they read my stuff on the internet, they would know who I was, they would see me as a legitimate voice, they would trust me. it's a hugely time-consuming issue and problem to build the trust and the legitimacy on a global scale on every issue from international organized crime to, you know, the menu's a very long one.
To come to the question that was asked, I think the problem is that the leaders of countries have become leaders of countries mainly by focusing on domestic politics. You don't succeed really by campaigning on foreign affairs unless in a very rare circumstance of extreme international stress. And a lot of the prime ministers that emerge in various countries haven't that much international experience. And they have to learn it on the job. And they learn it on the job as very much a third or fourth priority to dealing with healthcare or dealing with, you know, tax or whatever the principal issue that's going to determine the next election is going to be. So I think there's a lot to be said for investing in, you know, inter-parliamentary meetings where people who are on the way up in politics can meet one another. Bringing people who will eventually, may eventually be leaders of their countries, like the US Visitor Program. I benefited from that enormously by coming here so many years ago, I won't say. And I think that that sort of activity is very, very, very important. Leaders will never be adequately prepared for the situations they face. Leaders have to have the confidence to rely at times on their instinct. If they rely on things they know, well, they just never will know enough. So they just have to, you just have to hope that people have sound instincts. But I think Hattie has raised a really important point, and that's about legitimation. The US leadership is legitimated. You have a presidential election every 4 years, and that legitimates your leadership. You may or may not be happy with the decision you've made after you make it, but it's a decision that you've made, and you have responsibility for the decision. In Europe, it's a more depersonalized process, as Madeleine said a minute ago, in the sense that while we have a European Parliament who are individually elected, people don't feel that their vote in the European Parliament election changes the direction of Europe. I think it would be a very good thing if the President of the Commission was elected by the people of Europe in the same way as your President is elected by the people of the United States. While even if that person didn't have enormous power, the very fact of the people having a single conversation every 5 years about a personality is important. Most people, I think, judge politics through personality, through do I like that person or not? Do I like what I think she stands for or not? Rather than by analysing abstractions, most people haven't the opportunity or even maybe the vocabulary to deal with some of the abstract discussions that we might be having here. So we need to personalise power if we're to legitimate power. And the question is, how can that be done multinationally? It's not a problem for the United States because this country is big enough. It's not a problem for India. It's big enough and it's the biggest democracy in the world. But for Europe and for Africa and for Latin America, for the people who'll be negotiating on behalf of those blocs, there is some legitimacy problem. And I think we need to try and find a way of addressing it, to create the emotional glue that will keep all these well-designed intellectual boxes together.
Yeah. Well, I agree with everybody. But let me just add a little piece, if I may. I mean, the question, and I think the legitimisation point is absolutely spot on, but the question got me thinking on from another perspective, and that was the culture within which, you know, the said new leader would work, you know, what would be the new level of responsibilities, objectives, etc. I'm often amazed, actually, at how, you know, I've come attuned to this so quickly. I mean, I actually run a little business, a little, you know, personal. I run this damn thing the whole time. I couldn't even work it 4 months ago. But, you know, I've attuned myself to that. Now, is that, you know, network government? I haven't a clue, but I'm working that a damn sight faster than I was before. And I'm getting business done, and I'm cutting through layers, and I'm making decisions sometimes, you know, in concert with Booz Allen, I might add, that, you know, are quite significant. So it's the culture in which you work. But let me just give you one perspective from the military point of view. You know, I do a lot of mentoring for senior military commanders in UK. One of the things we've found is that, you know, you do need a different set of skills and a different set of tools to be what I would call the warfighting general, okay, and the post-conflict general. Now, you can have both sets in one individual, but that's not always the case. Because the warfighting general is, you know, directional, authoritative, etc., etc. The post-conflict general is quite consensorial. He has to be discursive. He has to get out and talk with a lot of the factions on the ground, etc. And there are different sets of skills. And, you know, we were talking this morning about the, you know, the warrior diplomat or the soldier diplomat. We all know them within history. But can you train for that? Probably not. Can you identify within a training process which individuals have that need? Yes, you can. And we do. So if that adds to the debate in some shape or form, and I absolutely agree with John, you know, the more you can link future leaders together to have these sorts of discussions in these sorts of institutes, that's the way you'll break this down.
Great. Thank you, Ian. This gentleman, at least I think you're a gentleman. If you're not, I'm sorry.
Arthur Mutambara from Zimbabwe. We in Africa are also having experiences and difficulties around building regional blocks, SADC, COMESA, East African Community, ECOWAS, AU, and now we're talking about the United States of Africa. One of the things that we're finding that we need to do is to change the way we think and have a paradigm shift from national sovereignty to regional sovereignty. We need civic education that actually changes the way our people think, the way our leaders think, to say we are moving away, explicitly moving away from national sovereignty to regional sovereignty. And beyond that, the logical conclusion is global sovereignty. What do the panels think about the idea of actually emphasizing that the future belongs to regional sovereignty and beyond that, global sovereignty?
Ms. Albright, you addressed this briefly
earlier. I think it's very hard. All one has to do is to look at what is happening now in terms of even smaller groups that are attracting people's identification, so that people are more and more identifying with their ethnic group, which sometimes is smaller than their national group, which is certainly in many ways different from regional. Now, one thing that could happen is that there's a variety of ethnic groups that are distributed through a region, and therefore then the ethnic groups provide a larger than national sovereignty, but not large enough, I think. I mean, but I think this is the big question, is who do you identify with? I have recently been writing about the role of religion in foreign policy, and part of what has happened is that the whole religious fervor has come, again, from identification with that. And to what extent do religious identifications go beyond the national sovereignty, which is sometimes helpful and sometimes terrifying to people? So I think one of the big questions that's going on now is, who do you identify with? And I'm not a sociologist, but people belong to more than one group. You are a worker, you are a parent, you are a Zimbabwean, you are an African. And the question is, what is the group that really is the one that gels you to other people? But that's the hard part now, because people are finding different places to put their loyalty, and it's all very, very much in flux. I have to say, as much as I'm for multilateral activities in every way, I do not see a global sovereignty happening. There's just more happening in terms of people wanting to identify with their own.
I think sovereignty is quite a difficult concept to get one's head around. Ultimately, every member of the European Union is sovereign in the sense that they can leave the European Union if they don't like what the European Union decides. But as long as they're in it, they have pooled their sovereignty and they accept majority or court decisions, as the case may be, on the issues which they have delegated. They've made a sovereign decision to delegate to the European Union, a delegation that they can withdraw if they wish, but they must withdraw from the entire package. They can't withdraw on an a la carte basis. I think the problem we have got to overcome is a tendency for big countries to want to have a la carte multilateralism, to be multilateral for the things that suit them and to opt out of the things that don't suit them. And I suppose this country has done that more than some others, shall we say. And that's understandable because the United States is the biggest economy in the world. And if you can do it, if you can get away with it, you'll do that sort of thing. But I think we've got to change that mindset generally and to get people to accept the whole package, to accept the good with the bad, knowing that ultimately they are sovereign in the sense that they can withdraw. I think the issue that Madeleine raises is particularly pertinent in the Middle East, where, in fact, I think people in the Middle East identify more with their religion than they do with their state. In fact, the states, many of them were created by Europeans, not by themselves. The boundaries were drawn by others, not by themselves. And it's natural, therefore, that you know, something that is of their own is what they give the greater degree of loyalty to than they do to the state, which is whose boundaries were drawn by somebody else. But I think the reality is that the human mind is well able to cope with having several different identities at the same time, several different affinities and loyalties. We're all used in various ways to juggling in our daily lives and juggling in our affinities and loyalties as well. And so long as we can make those trade-offs in a peaceful way, everything is fine. But in order to help us in that, we need some form of international rule of law. And that's where I think having an enforcement capacity that can go over the heads of individual governments and enforce directly, have the principle of direct effect, which is one of the principles of EU law. In addition to the primacy of EU law, there's the direct effect involvement, whereby EU decisions have direct effect in member states over the heads of the national government. That element of multilateralism, to my mind, is one of the things that would make it work and make all those multiple loyalties capable of being rendered compatible. Otherwise, you're going to have a la carte multilateralism, and in a way, it isn't multilateralism at all if it's a la carte.
Ashraf?
Yes, thank you. The first point is that the concept of sovereignty is really changed. I mean, now with the doctrine of duty to protect, the old notion of Westphalian sovereignty is no longer operational. If we are operating with that notion, that means effectively a nation state where there's a contract between citizens in the government. The problem with failing states or fragile states, 40 to 60 depending on how we count, is that that contract does not exist. Because of that, the question of loyalties is very much at issue. And of course, subdivisions, what we've seen is institutionalization of disorder within governments rather than governments themselves being the source of protection of population. The second is Europe, which was the homeland of the sovereign state, I think has made the greatest progress in terms of shared sovereignty, to being able to go towards a network model of governance where all these complex decision rights are balanced, as you were saying, Hattie, and began very small. So my third observation is that economics might be a much easier area of entry into this than politics per se. For instance, reform of the port of Karachi in Pakistan would bring $1 billion a year in benefits to Afghanistan. No amount of foreign aid from anybody else in the world would amount to the same. There are win-win possibilities in terms of regional infrastructure, but the problem with global with international multilateral institutions like the World Bank is that the sub-region is a zero concept for them. Very, very few intra-regional projects are undertaken in terms of trade, in terms of transport, in terms of these other facilitation. So the market building part might be the part of entry to really bring about a lot more cooperation than those difficult issues. And last observation, borders are a problem because the concept of the border is of a closed nation. And what you have now are open borders, particularly in places where the maps were drawn in some foreign office, most of the time London. He's Irish, so he doesn't mind. But Ian will have something to say about that.
All right. Hattie.
I feel as though I ought to be Ms. NGO here and come up with the sort of NGO response to that. And I'll wave that banner a little bit. Climate change is where I started off. And climate change, if everybody in the world hasn't yet embraced the fact that it's real, that it's human caused, that it's urgent and it needs to be addressed, it's happening. It'll happen later today and tomorrow especially, but it's happening. And here's a message. This message wouldn't be, I am for this kind of cap and trade system regulating greenhouse gas emissions, or I am for a carbon tax, or I am for a system or one or the other. I would hope that the next time we all come back to Aspen, we're all wearing a little pin that says cap at 450, cap greenhouse gas emissions at 450 parts, concentrations at 450 parts per million. We ought to say as global citizens, you guys who are responsible for this, whether it's nations, whoever it is, this is an urgent problem, and we're going to unite around solving it. This is a sort of the Jody Williams anti-landmine effort writ global. And that's the kind of effect that civil society can and should have. Not to say to the leaders, this is the structure we want you to use. This is the exact mechanism we want you to arrive at to solve the problem. But boy, do we want you to solve this.
It is the ultimate burning platform. Ian?
Well, I won't make a comment about maps. Because I think we did a little bit of that at Versailles in 1919. And I think we're still living with the consequences, all of us. So, I'll stop that one there. A little example, really, and I think it buys into totally what Madeline said about identity and interest. And the issue is Turkey, and it was fascinating. There was a sharp intake of breath when she produced her figures. I did a sort of not war game, that's a wrong term, but sort of game looking at the future of NATO about a year and a bit ago. And there were some heavyweights in the room, and we were looking. The academic said, I want a killer blow for NATO. Find one. So we looked at resurgent Russia, and we looked at immigration, and we went, we looked at WMD. We went right across the range, and I think we were all surprised by what emerged, and what emerged was losing NATO, losing Turkey. And that had been generated by a number of, and excuse the pun, young Turks around the table. Because they had said, in our current position, and I'm going to be quite brutal here, we have just had a rather rough time from the Americans over the Iraq issue. In fact, actually, I talked to the Deputy Chod about that, and he said we've been treated rather badly and we're feeling it, so point number one. The Kurdistan issue was, very foremost in their minds. The drift to Islamization was, also there. And, of course, the whole EU and the Christian Club piece, and the fact that now they're looking at that and can't see membership for probably at least another decade, is starting to make, I think, some Turks, and those Turks in what I would call pivotal positions, to think, well, where does our identity and our interests lie? And actually, I then probed the question and said, well, where do you think they lie? And they said, within our local region. Now, you've only got to draw a little circle around there and work out where their local region is. But it's an indication, I think, of exactly the point made by our Zimbabwean question and the point made by other panel members. It's happening. And it happens very subtly with political actions that might not see those wider consequences. Anyway.
Thank you, Ian. Yes, sir.
Yes, Juan Salgado, I'm an Aspen Institute fellow. Speaking of maps and borders and neighbors, our hemispheric neighbors are here in Latin America looking south. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, our interest as a country in Latin America has dramatically decreased. Although our demographics are going to force us over time to look south more, can we in the U.S., and this is most to Secretary Albright, begin to build from NAFTA toward a more European Union-type model on the incremental approach that's been talked about, or do we simply not have enough interest in Latin America or Mexico in particular?
Well, I happen to think that we have to pay more attention to Latin America, though I have to say it's never easy. When we don't pay enough attention, the countries in Latin America say, where are you? When we do, they say we are telling them what to do. So it's not an easy situation. And Hattie was our ambassador to the OAS, and we talked about this a lot in terms of the solidarity of the Americas, that there are any number of issues that we have a great deal in common, and that, especially as you mentioned, with the population flows and the money flows, the various way that the money, that the business as well as money going back from immigrants is something that is very important. The question is, and again it goes to something that John was saying, in terms of trade, we now have a series of bilateral agreements, some of which will get through Congress and some which will not, but we have gotten away from the concept of the Alliance of the Americas, where we were beginning to talk about how we saw each other as a Western Hemisphere region. I do think this is an agenda for the next president, because in fact, there are all the relationships that you're talking about. The OAS provides a pretty good institutional structure if we wanted to use it more. And to go to the building block idea, Mercosur as a trading block can provide a good building block for a more inter-American trade. And it's something we should look at, because there's a lot of Mercosur European trade, and we should be, in fact, much more involved in that. But Hattie, this is...
You used the word, you said our interest, I think, had, I hope, no, I don't want to misquote you, our interest had decreased. And I don't think our interest has decreased a bit. It's our engagement that's decreased. And the engagement, as Madeline points out, is a very neuralgic one. I mean, we are gringos because it's green go home. Soldiers in green go home. So there is that huge asymmetry in the hemisphere that makes all of this quite delicate. The OAS has proved to be quite a useful organization when there's, for example, democracy threatened in a small country. I mean, when I went to the OAS, I remember there was an auto coup or an attempted coup in Guatemala, and the OAS leapt to the rescue. The United States and all the member states supported the opposition to the military coup. It was over in, I don't know, a week and a half. It all worked very well. Multilateral organizations tend to work very well when the negative actions take place in very small countries. They tend to be much less useful with a Venezuela with its large population and large oil wealth, much less useful in a Chechnya that's within another large country. I mean, there are just some limits that we've not learned how to leap over. I think that one of the things that the next president ought to do is really focus on NAFTA and CAFTA, which NAFTA is the free trade order area of the North America, Canada, the United States, and Mexico, of CAFTA, which is the agreement with the Central American countries, and all of those issues that come out of those trade agreements, the labor set of issues, the environment set of issues, those are the areas where we can work on the legitimacy and work out the kinks. And I think those are useful vehicles. Madeline pointed out Mercosur in the Southern Cone. It is a neuralgic area. It is key to the United States of America. We are the Americas. And if we pretend that all the actions in Asia or all the actions someplace else, we're really missing the boat.
I have to say the most revolutionary thing I did at the State Department was to move Canada into the Western Hemisphere. For those of you that don't know how the State Department is organized, it was in Europe. And the reason that we did it was because it was important to have another strong democracy in terms of this solidarity of the Americas.
The poll that yourself and Senator Danforth sponsored shows quite favorable numbers for the United States in a large part of Latin America. And I think obviously there's a lot in what the questioner put, that you've a lot of good things to work with there in building a better relationship.
I want to thank the panelists and the audience.